The Old Testament reading is taken from Exodus 20, reading from the first verse. And God spake all these words, saying, I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the home of bondage. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself a graven image, or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water or under the earth. You shall not bow down to them or serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children of the third and the fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing steadfast love to thousands of those who love me and keep my commandments. You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless who takes his name in vain. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work. The seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. For it is you, and in it you shall not do any work, you, or your son, or your daughter, your manservant, or your maidservant, or your cattle, or your sojourner who is within your gates. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth and sea and all that is in them, and rested on the seventh day. Therefore, the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and hallowed it holy. Honor your father and your mother, that your days may be long in the land which the Lord your God gives you. You shall not kill. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife, or his manservant, or his maidservant, or his ox, or his ass, or anything that is your neighbor's. And the New Testament reading is John 2, starting at verse 13 to 22. The Passover of the Jews was at hand, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. In the temple, he found those who were selling oxen and sheep and pigeons, and the money changers at their business. And making a whip of cords, he drove them out with the sheep and oxen out of the temple, and he poured out the coins of the money changers and overturned their tables. And he told those who sold the pigeons, take these things away, you shall not make my father's house a house of trade. His disciples remembered that it was written, zeal for thy house will consume me. The Jews said to him, What sign have you to show me for doing this? Jesus answered them, destroy this temple, and in 3 days I shall raise it up. The Jews then said, it has taken 4 to 6 years to build this temple, and will you raise it up in 3 days? But he spoke of the temple of his body. When therefore he was raised from the dead, his disciples remembered that he had said this, and they believed the scripture and the word which Jesus had spoken. This is the word of the Lord.
What are we going to do about him? We need him off the streets before any more people start following him. This is getting beyond our control. Our authority is being questioned. The peace is being disturbed. Business is not going on as usual. If we don't stamp this out, who knows where it will lead? But it won't be good for us. Can't have people taking the law into their own hands. The system works fine as it is. What can we do? We can notify the Roman authorities. They don't like disturbances. Let them deal with him. Things will go back to normal. People will soon settle down. No one will remember.
So what makes you really angry? You know, angry to the point of tears. So angry that you just have to do something about it. That might include shouting or ranting or really telling someone what you think. Or it might mean even stronger action. Perhaps when someone doesn't do their fair share of the work. Or what about the neighbours who are unhelpfully noisy or constantly letting their garden get out of control so that it affects others? Perhaps it's other inconsiderate drivers. Or perhaps it's things like the exploitation of children as cheap labour, or the way street kids are cleared up like so much rubbish, or the way politicians feather their own nests, or only have a vision for their own party power rather than what's best for our society. Maybe things like the bedroom tax or the MPs who claim money for their duck ponds. How about racist remarks? Or, seeing as it's International Women's Day, sexist behaviour? Or the need for campaigns to highlight the evil of female genital mutilation, or something as simple as the rights of girls to education. I thought about getting us to paint something purple together this morning in order to join in with the campaign. A nice purple stripe right up the middle of the aisle would have been very lovely, wouldn't it? But I took to just wearing some purple instead. Maybe it's watching other people suffer that makes you angry. Enough to act, enough to do something about it? Does it make you feel nervous when you hear that kind of language? We're very aware these days of the effects of religious extremism and what some people are willing to do because of what they believe. Human history is littered with atrocities carried out in the name of one God or another. It's not like we who've sung Onward Christian Soldiers Marching As to War have much of a moral high ground from which to cast our words of condemnation. It's not just religious beliefs, of course, but political beliefs, nationalistic beliefs, or even no beliefs. Sometimes it's just circumstances and choices to act. And in what way? What's an appropriate response and what's it based on? Is Jesus an extremist? Or just very, very angry? All the other gospel writers have the story of the clearing of the temple much later on in Jesus' ministry. It's often linked to the Holy Week story, in particular following on from Palm Sunday. And so very much linked to the idea that Jesus was the expected Messiah, come to set his people free. For some, a revolutionary that would disappoint. For others, a sign of resistance and hope for freedom from Roman rule. And for others, a sign of the end times themselves. But John places the story in chapter 2, right after the wedding of Cana. The first sign Jesus performs by turning all the water into wine, thus saving the wedding and ensuring a very good party is had by all. I wondered whether the fact that the next verse on in between that story and this says that they took several days to recover. He says to his mum at the wedding, "My hour has not yet come. Why are you bothering me with the problem of not having enough wine?" But he did as his mother said anyway, and it says he showed his glory. Then very next thing is him going up to Jerusalem near Passover time and finding the temple going about its business, right? Menagerie, come zoo with money changers and money changing hands. More the worship of mammon than the worship of God, you might say. Of all the New Testament Gospels, it's John that places the greatest emphasis on love. Throughout his book, the love of the Father for the world is reiterated time after time. It's because of the Father's love that Jesus the Son is sent into the world. So isn't it interesting that it's in John's Gospel where Jesus' anger is most clearly depicted? All the Gospels tell of how Jesus cleansed the temple, using whips to do it, but John puts it right at the beginning. It's as if he's saying, this action is a kind of pattern for understanding all that is to come later. So an angry action sets the tone for a gospel in which love is so prominent. How can this be? Can anger and love go together? Well, I began to think about that. It's particularly strange when you think about some of our traditional images or ways of talking about Jesus. Gentle Jesus, meek and mild. Many of the artistic impressions of Jesus are like this image of Jesus surrounded by lambs and birds, looking all benign and lovely, and often there's a child in there too. But a few years ago, a poster was produced by the church's advertising network. Bright red with a Jesus that looked like a revolutionary Che Guevara type. The caption with it said, "Meek and mild, as if." And there was a real outcry about it. Some people were really offended by it. Jesus would never have been like this. But John says, if we fail to take seriously this angry Jesus, this Jesus who took a whip and drove out the moneylenders and the animals being sold, who overturned and upset people going about their business, then we fail to understand who this Jesus is. We've resorted to a comfortable, cozy Jesus who makes everything nice and doesn't upset things. And worse, we will have failed to understand love. Jesus reflects God's own character when he takes that whip and clears out the temple, the jealous God who gave us commandments. For he acts to demonstrate God's anger at the way he is ignored by people, used by them for personal gain, taken for granted. Jesus' anger is against a people who turned God's house into a market and who used a system of temple currency to exploit the poor. So a gentleman called Carter Hayward wrote, "Love is full of such yearning, such adamant insistence for right relations, such compassion, such rage, and it is absolutely irrepressible. Love is not a weak, insipid emotion. We call Jesus' death on a cross the passion story, because it's about the lengths that love will go to. And the story of his passion begins in places like the temple, where he's so enraged by what has grown there that he's moved to action. It's an act of passion. It was highly inflammatory. A dangerous outburst. His actions marked his card, set his course, caught attention and won him enemies in high places. He wasn't playing it safe when he gave rein to his anger. His reason couldn't overcome his deep rage at the way his father's house was being used. In his mind, the ones he'd just walked by to get into the temple, the beggars on the steps, the sick and the needy, the others walked right on by, heads held high. The place where the poor should have been most welcome, where they should have found help, was a place to exploit them, making their misery worse. Jesus, the Word made flesh, sees for himself just how far inside the temple God has been locked away. How could people, why would they come to the Father if this was the way they were treated? The people who represented God had made him impossible to find, let alone come close to. They had made him irrelevant. But Jesus, the way, the truth, the life, Jesus, the one who most clearly showed us what God is like, lets his love pour out in his anger, not to damage and destroy people, but to disturb and disrupt and reclaim the holy ground. He rails against the system that excludes and oppresses people, offering no hope, and cuts them off from the God who once traveled in their midst and walked with them in gardens, who provided in the wilderness and brought them to the land of promise when they had nowhere to call home. Of course, love and anger can be a dangerous combination, we know that, especially when it's turned into personal vendetta. There's a selfish kind of anger that causes people to hit out at others who've hurt them. And who am I to judge? But the beginning place for this is not love, but hate. And there's no hope found in that way. Equally, there's times when we need to wake up from our lethargy and apathy and act like we care at all. Jesus walks this middle line, and it will cost him dearly, the cost of love. Here is hope that things can be different and that people can find their way to a more whole existence where peace has a chance. And sometimes all it takes is walking. The determination to walk across a bridge in order to reclaim one's humanity. Yesterday was also the 50th anniversary of the first Selma walk, where peaceful protesters set off to march from Selma to Montgomery that ended up as Bloody Sunday, one of the first. Tomorrow is the anniversary of the second march, when Martin Luther King and others confronted the same hatred and prejudice. Clergy and sympathizers from other states arrived to join the march. And one of them, a Reverend James Reeb from Boston, was murdered that evening by a white gang. Then there was a national outcry. And the president had to step in. A voting rights bill was tabled in Congress, and the army was dispatched to Selma. The third march took place on the 21st, with 2,000 soldiers of the U.S. Army, 1,900 members of the Alabama National Guard under federal command, and many FBI agents and federal marshals. The marchers averaged 10 miles a day along U.S. Route 80, known as Alabama as the Jefferson Davis Highway. Some of us will remember that. They arrived in Montgomery on March the 24th and at the Alabama State Capitol on March the 25th, with thousands having joined the campaign. 25,000 people entered the capital city that day in support of voting rights. People who had caught the vision and become angry enough to walk. To walk together. Let me end with another question. Not about anger, but about love. What do you love so much that you would march 54 miles or paint things purple? Or clear a temple? Or, well, do something, anything about it.